Hey, Prepper Recon fans, welcome to another edition of the PrepperRecon.com podcast. Our mission is to bring you great interviews with preppers from around the globe so you can be better informed and better prepared for everything from a hurricane to the end of the world as we know it. Today's guest is Glenn Tate, the author of the 299 Days book series. Glenn, thanks for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. This is great. I'm really looking forward to an economically focused podcast. But good that you're doing that. So thank you for getting information out about that.
All right. Good, good. Give us a real brief overview of the 299 Days book series first.
Yeah, this would be the 32nd version of what the book is about. It's a 10 book series. It's already been written. Books 1 through 5 are already out. Book 6 comes out at the end of May. And it's about me, I'm the main character, and a guy who was a suburban slug and became a prepper. I have a job that allows me to look in on state government. I live in the state capital of Washington State, Olympia, Washington. And some of the experiences I've had, some of the friends I have, some of the experiences my friends have told me about who are in and around government. And I could see that things were going to fall apart, rather hard and violently, at least in the beginning. And I started preparing for it, became a prepper, and then started writing about what happened, my transformation from suburban slug to prepper. Now I do a lot of things with guns. I train people on tactical things. I have some preps down. And so book one is about that transformation. Books 2 through 10 are about what happens in the collapse and in the aftermath of the collapse. Book 10 touches on some of the rebuilding that's going to go on. And the very short version of the plot is that some good guys rally at a place out in the country, out of my cabin, and are joined by some more good guys. And good guys take back the state of Washington because the bad guys, the loyalists, the legitimate authorities, as they call themselves, the former government, they're pretty weak because they can't pull off all the bad things they want to do because they don't have the support of the general population, number one. They don't have the resources. They don't have the fuel. They don't have the spare parts. Computer systems are up and down and all of that. It's a story of a partial collapse. Not a complete collapse, but a partial collapse, in my view, is what's going to happen. Utilities will stay on for the most part, and there still will be some government services. In some parts of the country, there will be way too many government services in an oppressive sense. In other parts of the country, there will be little or no formal government. And in much of the country, there will be some sort of gradation in between lots of government and little government. So it's not the apocalyptic version, because I don't think that's going to happen. I think it'll be a partial collapse. So that, in a slightly longer than 30-second nutshell,
sure,
is what the 10-book, 3,200-page book series is about. It's hard to summarize that.
Yeah, sure. That's it's a lot of content. Very good. So, Glenn, what keeps you up at night? What do you see as being the number one catalyst to causing a collapse?
Well, those are... in some ways, two different questions. I'll start with the catalyst for the collapse, I believe, is an economic collapse that's coming. And by that, I mean government spending way too much money. We all know the statistics about that. And government not being able to pay all the people it's promised money to. I'm basically a political guy. Mm-hmm. I don't mean I try to get elected to things. I mean, I work in a business that involves a lot of politics. Again, you know, I'm in the state capitol, so you can do the math on that. And I see that all these politicians of both parties, I might add, have promised all these things that can't be paid for. So the government, as a mathematical certainty, will run out of money. There's absolutely no way to pay all these promises off. And so then you're going to have a cascading failure of the political system, mm-hmm. because all these people that have been promised these things, and in a lot of ways are actually dependent on these things,
they've been trained to be dependent.
Exactly. They've been trained to be dependent. They don't know any other way, and they have absolutely no skills to take care of themselves. And they're going to be furious, and they're going to start stealing and doing some bad things. So that's how I see the collapse coming. It would probably be coupled with very, very bad inflation. I don't know that hyperinflation necessarily. Mm-hmm.
But you don't have to have hyperinflation to really have a failure of currency.
Exactly right. Exactly right. You can just have 10, 15% a year inflation. Of course, that's probably about what we have now if we actually measured it. Probably
yeah,
closer
I think,
to 7 or 8%. But
I think John Williams over at Shadow Stats estimates it at about 10%.
Yeah. And so, you know, even that level of inflation would be bad. I think that we'll continue to have really ridiculous public policy choices being made by the federal government and many state governments and just strangling the economy. Obviously, Obamacare kicks in full force in 2014. That'll
just
be a
keep
disaster.
Going from bad to worse.
Exactly. And so all these things will line up. It's not as if one day you'll turn on the television and there'll be a scroll at the bottom that says the United States of America has collapsed today. It'll come suddenly and it'll be dramatic. I think it'll unfold in a matter of days, but the run up to it will be a matter of weeks. But I think that the big event that will trigger much of this will be a catastrophic decline in the value of the dollar, which is another way of saying inflation is imminent. I think that people who invest in the United States, a lot of foreign governments, of course, the biggest purchaser of U.S. Treasury bonds is the Social Security Administration and Fannie and Freddie and the Federal Reserve,
the
of Fed. Course.
So, yeah, they're buying $45 billion worth a month.
Yep.
And then another $40 billion in mortgage-backed securities that goes to the banks, and I think the banks probably a lot of that they end up buying treasuries with. So,
yep. And at some point, the regular people out there, and by that I would mean Americans and pension funds and foreign investors—that is to say, not the federal government—regular people are going to say, "Why in the world would I invest in this system that is borrowing currently probably 45 cents of every dollar spent? It's just completely unsustainable." And so there'll be a massive sell-off of bonds, or there could be a spike in interest rates, which I guess would happen as a necessary corollary. There would be all kinds of things. That would be the dramatic part that would get some people noticing what's going on. The average person, the average American out there, won't really notice things until all of a sudden one day the EBT cards and the SNAP cards, that's of course the new acronym for food stamps.
Right.
Those things will be turned off because the federal government will just not have any money. It could also happen more slowly if the federal government keeps putting the same amount of Federal Reserve notes into people's accounts and those Federal Reserve notes have less and less value. So one way or another, there will be a dramatic event. In the book, it occurs on May Day, which was symbolic on my part.
Yeah.
And then there's this big political, not even a political backlash, not in the sense of there's an election and people vote for different people, not that kind of political backlash. I'm talking about people in the streets breaking stuff and demanding things. And of course,
like we see in the rest of the world, like we see in Greece,
exactly,
and Spain. And
exactly. The Russian collapse in the early 90s and the Argentine collapse in about 2000 were models that I have in mind for what would happen to America. Now, America was different. Number one, we have a lot of guns, and that changed a lot of things.
It changes a lot of things. That makes it a little more dangerous
situation,
well,
yeah, I mean,
too.
I think it makes it less dangerous, to be honest, because I think that we can defend ourselves against criminals, and I think we also will keep government in check. I think when there's this big failure economically and politically, the many in law enforcement and the military will initially rally around their command and go and do things to stop the crisis, and there'll be riots, and a lot of good people in law enforcement will say, "Like, goodness, we have to restore order." Well, that'll last for a couple of days. And then I think many in law enforcement and the military will realize they're being ordered to do things that are unconstitutional. I also think a huge chunk of law enforcement, in particular in the military, I guess some, will go home to their families. They're going to be, you know, up for 4 days in a row trying to fight off riots, and at some point they're going to realize there aren't enough police to possibly protect everybody and do all the things that people have come to expect. You know, they expect a 30-second response time on a 911 call.
Right.
And the police and the military are going to say, you know what, I can't save this country, and they're going to melt away and go back to their families. And I don't view the collapse as, in the long term, the beginning of political oppression or a dictatorship. That will happen in some areas. I think the big cities will have that. And it'll go on somewhere. There will be some rogue police and military units that will be gangs. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not, you know, saying sunshine and lollipops for anyone in uniform, but I think by and large, the military and law enforcement folks will do the right thing. And a lot of them will do the right thing by simply quitting and going and taking care of their own things. And so,
Well, hopefully books like yours and groups like Oath Keepers will help some of our military and law enforcement think about what they're going to do before the collapse come and help them make the right decision when it does happen. You had a real a recent article on 299days.com. You had a real neat graphic that showed how many EBT card holders there are per Walmart in America. I think it was 44 million EBT card holders and 3,500 Walmarts, and that's about 14,000 EBT card holders per Walmart.
Yeah, exactly. And it was actually SNAP cards, which are food stamps. EBT is, you know, in some states is something else. But anyway, yeah, it's basically food stamps, but same idea. And by the way, the 44 million figure is from 2011, and there's probably going to be closer to 50 million people on food stamps by the end of this year. But let's just use the old numbers because that's what we have. And so they figured out that that means that there are about 14,000 people on food stamps for every Walmart in the United States. And it's not a rip on Walmart. It's just, you know, handy because almost every town has a Walmart. So, you know, someone listening to this should close their eyes, not if they're driving, and imagine the Walmart in their town. Think about it. You were probably there, you know, a while ago. Think about being at your local Walmart. Now think about 14,000 people, that in your area where your Walmart is that are on food stamps. The infographic on my site, and you'll probably link to it on yours,
yes, I will.
Is amazing because it's a computer-generated thing, and it shows a view from a few hundred feet up if you were looking at a Walmart. So it's got an average-sized Walmart there, and it's got a football field next to it to provide some scale. And then it shows what 14,000 people look like, and it's a little computer-generated, nice, orderly line that kind of snakes like an S back and forth. And you see that the parking lot and then some, a couple parking lots, would be filled with people. And think about that. And there are a variety of levels to think about that. Number one, the sheer numbers of people on food stamps. But number two, let's say you're the Walmart, and all these people on food stamps no longer have any money on their SNAP card or EBT or any other card, and they're furious, and they're hungry, and they're scared, and they're dependent. What do you think that means? About 8 minutes into it, that Walmart's going to be stripped bare. Another thing that I think is amazing from all this is to think about the fact that the government in your town, let's say the police force, let's say there's 30 or 40 police officers, and maybe with some state police nearby, you bring it up to state 50 police officers. 50 police officers trying to hold back 14,000 angry, hungry people, they can't possibly be done. This is why I think police melt back into the general population after a few days. But that's bad enough for your local government to be worrying about. Now you're the federal government, and you've got 3,500 of these problems on your hand. You cannot possibly function. You don't, as a federal government, you don't have the resources to be oppressive. You don't have the personnel, as I mentioned, the fuel and the spare parts. You can't possibly pull off some of the nightmare oppression scenes that I guess could happen and could happen in limited areas. So I think that really describes everything, that infographic, that what a problem we've gotten ourselves into when we have to have a problem like this. So it's an amazing thing. And again, a picture's worth a thousand words, which is, you know, maybe not great for a podcast, but people will go and look at it, and with this context they're hearing about it, I think they'll really get a lot out of it. It's a great thing, by the way, to share with friends and family. You don't have to talk to people's ear, you don't have to talk people's ear off about, you know, Ludwig von Mises, who they've never heard of or anything like that. You can simply send them this link and say, huh, 14,000 people per Walmart. Boy, well, that's kind of a bad situation, and they'll figure out why it's a bad situation. It's a great persuasion piece.
Yeah, it's a good wake-up tool.
Mm-hmm.
So can we make some changes now to stop the collapse, or is it too late?
It's entirely too late. You know, I'm an optimist, and I don't live in a bunker, and I don't cry and, you know, all of that kind of stuff, but it's entirely too late. The United States, and I think politically, and by that I don't mean elect me to student government body, you know, office and that kind of stuff. Well, I mean public policy-wise, and I think in terms of how to get large groups of people to do what you want, and so that's what I mean by politically. We are not at all ready in this country to do the things that are necessary to quit being this dependent. We could not simply quit spending this amount of money. So many people are dependent on it, and they're not all dirtbags. There are a lot of people in this country, baby boomers in particular, who have planned their financial futures around federal entitlement programs. I wish they wouldn't have, and I acknowledge that because baby boomers are such a gigantic voting bloc, that whatever baby boomers want, the United States government's going to do, and I think that's in a lot of ways why we're in this predicament. It's not just baby boomers to blame, don't get me wrong, but I mean, it's politically and economically speaking, it's a driving force. And so we can't, you know, wave a wand and become the Americans we used to be a few generations ago. We simply don't have it in us, and we couldn't pull it off if we wanted to. That's why I think a collapse is what fixes this. I don't want it. There's going to be a lot of people hurt. There's going to be a lot of destruction. I don't want it. I want to be wrong. I want so badly to be wrong and look back at this and say, well, remember in the early 2000 teens or 2010s or whatever we end up calling this decade, remember when I was all scared about the collapse of the United States? Boy, did I overreact.
Yeah.
I'd love for that to happen. But no, I don't think it can be fixed. Mathematically, it cannot be fixed. We cannot, you know this, I mean, from all the political stuff, we can't even, with a Republican House of Representatives at the federal level who are supposed to protect us from all these things, we can't even stop increases in the rate of growth, let alone slowing growth, let alone curbing actual spending. And even if we never spend another dollar and we just let inflation sort of take away the purchasing power of all the spending we're doing, it would still take decades to get into any kind of manageable level of debt to GDP, which means also the GDP side is a problem. We would have to have very free economic system, which we're never going to have because too many people are politically against it. They're taught in schools, in government schools, to, you know, hate rich people and expect free things. And so we would have to have a roaring free economy coupled with a big reduction in spending. And I can't see either one of those two things happening. And it would take both. We can't just, quote, grow our way out of this as many Republicans suggest. By the way, I'm a libertarian, moderate libertarian is what I call myself, so not a partisan guy. But, you know, it can't be fixed, and that's the problem. And more people are recognizing this without, I don't know, giving away things that I shouldn't give away because people can maybe figure out what I do, and also to protect people I've had very confidential conversations with. Many people, at least in Washington state government, I shouldn't say many people, I should say some high-ranking people in Washington state government that I've personally spoken with, they know that this is unsustainable. They know this can't go on, and they know bad things are coming. And in one case in particular, someone who I think is pretty high-ranking, actually, he's a prepper. Now, what does that tell you? The people who know the trends and all of this, at least the one I know in particular, and there are others, are preppers. So that should give you an idea that this thing is completely, completely unfixable. But that's not a depressing thing. I mean, I wish it were fixable. Believe me, unfixable is not optimal. But it'll get fixed. And if people take some reasonable precautions in the prepping field, they start doing even a little prepping and they get mentally prepared, I think that's the most important prep of all. And by that, I mean, understand that bad things are going to happen and not be surprised when they do and not not freak out and scream and run around, but instead be very rational and coping in the situation. So you can do some things. Since I believe a partial collapse is coming, it'll be more survivable than other collapse scenarios, and you just may come out the other end in a pretty good position if you have some gold and silver, for example.
To preserve your wealth.
By the way, not a financial guy, not giving anybody financial advice. In all candor, I don't have any gold and silver, and the reason is I have a tremendous amount of ammunition.
Okay. That's a precious metal right there, right? Copper jacketed lead?
That's right.
For the past five months, it's been trading at a premium.
Yeah, that's right. No, that's exactly right. Heck, 22 long rifles trading at a premium right now. I never thought I'd see that. Actually, I did think I'd see it, which is why I got so much of it when it was cheap. And now I'm loaning it out to my friends. If you have some kind of business or skill that will be useful post-collapse, you could do just fine. And for example, in the book, it's detailed, and it's all true, about the guys I call the team, and they're friends of mine. We started shooting together, and we turned into, we teach people how to shoot tactically, and we think that after a collapse, we'll be a pretty successful security company, and we will protect good people from bad people. We will not work for bad people, and we think do just fine. Now, is it some giant business idea? Is it this great, idea to go into business? Nope, not at all. I would love to keep my day job. I just don't think my day job is going to be around much longer. And so when bad things happen, it's not a business in the sense of let's make a bunch of money and, get big screen TVs and drink champagne and, stuff like that. It's not that kind of thing. Business has become such a terrible word in the United States that I have to sort of back away from that word, but I think people understand it would be more of a vocation. And so if you can fix vehicles, if you have any medical skills, a nurse, a doctor, a dentist, a veterinarian,
a farmer,
what's that?
A farmer.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yes. Farmers are going to be in such great demand. And if you can do things like that, you'll do well with yourself and your family and take care of them, but I think you're going to be able to come out of this ahead of it because there will be so many consumers who have no way of otherwise providing for themselves, and you'll have valuable things. So I think people should start thinking about their post-collapse career, right? That's how I view the security business.
Yeah, that's smart.
Post-collapse. Yeah. And diversify. You always need to have a plan for everything. And since there will be a collapse, in my opinion, people, and if they're listening to your podcast, they probably agree with that. They need to have a plan of some kind. And you can be creative, but be thinking about things that will be in demand during a collapse. If you want to be a Middle Ages Franco-Roman literature critic, you're probably in bad luck during the collapse. So keep it practical, and should be just fine.
Yeah. Now, in the rebuild stage, because I think your book, we're going to have a rebuild. We're not just going to descend into chaos and stay there. In the rebuild stage, what are some solutions? Do we return to a gold-backed currency?
Yeah, absolutely. The rebuild is outlined in the last book, and then actually outlined in book 9, and then in book 10, and this is going to be all new material. It's going to be the 43 colonels. There are 43 colonels, honorary colonels, who were designated by the new Washington legislature in the first chapter of the book. And I'm going to describe them, and there's going to be a description of all the different kinds of people and different talents it takes to rebuild. And these colonels did things to help clean house, as I euphemistically call it. And we're going to see things. There's an economist. There is a financial person. There's a medical person who starts a hospital. There's a smuggler. There's actually two smugglers. A miner is a person who digs for gold, by the way. There's a fair amount of gold in Washington State. And so you're going to see all these different perspectives. There are some military people who do some military things, and some political people who do political things. You're going to see through the one chapter biographies of each one of these colonels all the different skills that it takes and all the things that need to be done. But to outline, back to that in Chapter 9, there's a rewriting of the Washington State Constitution that is described a little bit, not in a lot of legal detail, so it's boring, but there's something called the High Five Amendment, is what I call it, and that's a state constitutional amendment limiting state spending to 5% of gross domestic product, and gross domestic product would be measured accurately and fairly, unlike it currently is, where the Federal Reserve accounts for, I think, 16% of the GDP of the United States simply by printing money. That counts as a sixth economy. So that sort of thing. So there would be hard caps on the size of government, gold and silver. There would be free currencies. People could use different currencies. I see a return to banknotes coming. And in the 1700s and most of the 1800s, small local banks would issue banknotes, and they were negotiable. They were like cash. Now, there were some problems with it. Some banks would issue too many banknotes, and then there would be inflation, and the banknotes would be worthless. After the Revolutionary War, this was a problem with states and banks doing it. But there would be some ways to require the banks, not necessarily with laws, because those rarely work, but basically the banks that printed too many banknotes would go out of business. And you know what? If you just come off basically a civil war, and you start at the bank issuing a bunch of banknotes and ripping people off, everybody and their dog has an AR-15 at this point in history. And you know what? It's probably a really bad idea to try to steal from a bunch of people who just got done shooting a bunch of people who tried to steal from them earlier. So that's the non-legal remedy I see to that sort of thing. And so it would be that, and it would be a return to people working. I'm not trying to be funny or facetious, but you know, a lot of Americans don't work, and a lot of them don't work very much at all. Well, we're not going to have that luxury when there are no more EBT and SNAP cards. No. And so people will work again, and we will have, in many ways, a lower standard of living, but it won't be a destitute standard of living. It'll be maybe the 50s, the 40s, 50s, something like that, where people did just fine. They were basically comfortable, but didn't have all these goofy distractions and wasteful things. I see a return to that because that's the only standard of living that would be economically feasible. By the way, it would not happen overnight. I mean, you'd go from basically post-collapse, post-low-scale, mild civil war. I think it would be low-scale and mild simply because the loyalists would crumble pretty quickly. I don't see a million-man army in blue uniforms versus a million-man army in gray uniforms. I don't see anything nearly as dramatic and formal as that. But after this period, it would be tough. A lot of people will be hungry. Quite a few people will probably die of starvation. There'll be all kinds of needless diseases. I mean, needless deaths, from easily prevented diseases, but not massive die-off sorts of things. After every civil war, there is a food shortage or a famine, take your pick, and there is always an outbreak of diseases, and so I foresee that happening. But again, I'm not talking a 90% die-off rate by any means.
No.
Most people, in my view, will make it through this. Most people will make it through it. That's what happened in Russia, and that's what happened in Argentina, and I think that's what will happen here. So, the rebuilding would require a complete reset of the economic, the political system. I'll tell you, we would make things in the United States. Now, I'm a big fan of free trade, don't get me wrong. I'm not a protectionist by any means, but we don't make anything in this country, and it's absurd. I got a thing of peaches, not a can, but it was like one of those chilled plastic things of fresh-cut peaches, and it's very tasty. I looked at it, and I was stunned. It was made in China. Don't we have peach trees in Georgia?
That's crazy.
So you grow peaches, and you can them, and you put peaches, which are mostly water, and the peaches didn't cost that much either. I can't believe it. And then you put it on a ship, and it had to be refrigerated, I believe. But anyway, you put it on a ship and you ship it from China because it's cheaper to grow and process to ship peaches all the way from China.
That doesn't sound sustainable.
I mean, oh my goodness, no. And so we will make things here again, and of course we can't make things here because of various regulatory things, and it's kind of hard to find, in a lot of cases, anybody that wants to actually work with their hands. So it'll be slow, but it'll come back, and we will have learned all kinds of things that went wrong. Now, I keep saying we, and I keep painting a rosy picture, and I should be more specific. Many places will have this slow but steady rebuilding, and things will work well. There will still be parts of the FUSA, which is the former United States of America, as I refer to it in the book. Parts of the FUSA will be like Chicago and New York, and they'll just be absolute messed up garbage heaps. And they'll probably keep doing it, too, because, we've seen it in the present tense, in the current day. Some parts of the country, they just love to elect people who are robbing them blind and treating them terribly, and they seem to get reelected, and actually most of the people who get elected who do it run unopposed. So, you know, some people must enjoy it. It must be some masochistic kind of thing. And so I think there will be, you know, that. But in much of the country, I'm going to say the Mountain West, the Deep South, and then pockets of places like Washington State, which as a whole is very statist, but rural Washington, rural Western Washington, and Eastern Washington would be in this category of free states, as I would call them. And I think that you'll see things coming around in places like that, and slowly people will migrate from the bad places to the good places, much like people have for a couple hundred years come from other parts of the world to America when America was relatively better. And I think we're going to see that. I don't think there will be 50 states that much longer, a matter of years. I think a lot of states will, as I call it in the book, opt out, and they'll just kind of slowly quit listening to the federal government. Again, no, oops, got some police here, and I got a phone up to my ear, so I'm going to have to be a little stealthy.
Sure.
There we go. I turned the corner. Good boy. I think I just admitted to a crime on a podcast, which is a really kind of silly thing to do.
You did, but I guess nobody has your true identity, so it doesn't really help.
That's right. That's right. No, and I just saw him in my rear view turn the other way, so I'm okay.
Good.
But anyway, kind of a jolt of adrenaline. Anyway, but so anyway, I see regional variances, and I don't see 50 states. This union we're in is far too large, 310 million people. Republics have never been bigger than a few million. If you look back in history, republics work really well when they're, I don't know, city states in Europe or the American colonies, or early states, I should say, back in the 1700s into early 1800s. They work well with few hundred thousand or a few million people, but when you get this big, you can't possibly govern yourself and have any kind of accountability. So that's in a nutshell what I see. And you can see how everything I've described is economically and politically intertwined.
Mm-hmm. And I know you're too smart to make a prediction on when the collapse is going to happen, but if you had to pick a date, what would that date be?
I quit trying to predict this a while ago, and the reason is I was terribly wrong. And I kept thinking it should have happened by now. I'm surprised that it hasn't happened by now. So my timetable is off. I think that it could be as soon as a matter of months. A matter of a few years, I think, is certainly reasonable. I don't see the collapse taking a decade. It could. The Federal Reserve and the federal government have all kinds of magical powers to do things to delay this. And I'm constantly amazed by that. They have tricks up their sleeve that you and I don't even know about, and they obviously aren't going to tell us. And so maybe they can keep this thing held together, a little bit longer, or longer than I think. But I think it's certainly a matter of our lifetimes. I don't think it's, one of these things where, it'll be our kids. that see what's happening. And yeah. So yeah, a couple years. I mean, that's as close as I can come, but that's as good of a guess as any.
Yeah, I think I think you're right. Fundamentally, it should have already happened. I think it's just the confidence. It's like we saw the housing bubble. The fundamentals for the housing bubble breakdown were present in 2006, but it didn't really, the confidence didn't begin to shake until 2008, and then it took another year for it to completely descend.
Exactly. We're dealing with 310 million people who are, for the most part, completely uninformed. And I'm not saying that as an elitist. I'm uninformed about baseball, for example. And if you judge me based on that, then I'm a loser. So, okay, I'm a loser. So, you know, I'm not going to judge people on that, but they do need to have some economic and political knowledge so they can govern themselves. If we were in a republic, that would be the case, but we're not. So, and so they're not going to know things. And the normalcy bias of the American people is stunning. And of course, that's a term that means people that assume everything will be normal. And when they're confronted with things that are out of the normal, out of the norm, out of the ordinary, like, you know, no food in a grocery store, that would be out of the ordinary. They can't process it. And they have this bias towards thinking that everything will be normal. And in some cases, it's almost a psychosis. It can become this irrational belief that everything is indeed normal. An example of that, and this is described in various ways through various characters in the book, is that somebody might say, well, what do you mean there's no food at our local grocery store? That's crazy. I have these one kind of frozen pancakes or frozen waffles or whatever, and I really like them, and you're telling me they don't have them because the dollar crashed today and everybody went out and got waffles? So I'm going to go to the next store, you know, the one second closest to my house, and oh, yeah, there's a bunch of sirens wailing, and I can hear gunshots because everybody's getting carjacked. But I'm going to go to the store because, doggone it, I want these waffles because these waffles will soothe me and make me think that everything's normal because I cannot believe that all this stuff is happening. So somebody gets in their car, wasting precious gasoline, I might add, and they go to that next store, and they're carjacked and shot. That would be an example of normalcy bias, you know, to the extreme. But I think the whole country, to some extent, has normalcy bias, and it would take a long time for them to get how much things changed, and so it would take a while. That's why I think that events that would perhaps happen instantly, and you and I would know, are the sign that this thing has collapsed, and we would know in an instant to start doing all the things we need to do in our planning and bugging out and doing all these things. Other people would take days or maybe even a couple weeks to figure out because, you know, yeah, there's a bunch of sirens and gunshots and the stores are empty, but did you see who's on Dancing with the Stars tonight? I mean, I honestly, that's half humorous, but half true. And, you know, so that it would take a great deal of time. And that's a good thing for us. And I know that sounds very cruel, doesn't it? But if the rest of the population, by and large, isn't figuring this out, and they're taking a long time to figure this out, that means we have more time to go to the store, get a bunch more food. We have a bunch of time to get out of cities. We have a bunch of time, if we're bugging in, to fortify our positions and to do what we need to do to gather some water. And if we've got a network of folks, maybe some medical folks we can count on, we can kind of activate our network and have the medical people, maybe we all bug into one house in one place or whatever you need to do.
Yeah.
And we're going to have more time and more warning, and that's good for us. I don't want to put anybody else at a disadvantage, but you know what? If you've been living your life, driving your kids, you know, to soccer games, until 9 o'clock at night, you know, you work all day and you got to pay a bunch of taxes, you and your wife work and driving your kids to soccer games and all you do on the weekends is Little League and it's for the kids and you're saying it's very important, and yes, it is very important to spend a lot of time with your kids, but you're doing all these normal suburban American things, and there were all these signs out there that things were going poorly, and you kind of got sucked up and caught into the normal life, because it's very comfortable to be a normal American. It's very, very comfortable. Nobody ever accuses you of being a weirdo.
No.
And so nobody ever says, why do you have, you know, these pinto beans, and why do you own an AR-15? That's really creepy and weird. And you never have that discomfort and that awkward conversation. Well, guess what? You're going to probably need pinto beans and an AR-15 at some point. So, you should have.
It's better to have them. It's better to have them and not need them than need them and not have them, isn't it?
Exactly right. Exactly right. You know, and the beans, after a while, you can, and let's say nothing bad happens, you can donate the beans to a food bank, and AR-15s are a lot of fun, even if there's never a need to use them. They're just a joy. I mean, they're wonderful, fun things, and you can spend time with your kid. Yeah, you spend time with your kids shooting, and you know, maybe still do some soccer games or whatever. And I'm just picking on soccer and everything, but I see a lot of that suburban busyness, which is something else that I think is going to be cured in this reset. I think we're going to look back and say, did we really spend all this time and money and energy living this kind of artificial suburban life and keeping up the airs and I don't know, competing with the Joneses and all the other stuff that I think that, you know, quite a few Americans do? It's what I used to do. It's where I used to be at. And thank goodness that's not me anymore.
Gotcha.
So yeah, people could get ready, and a lot of them aren't, and that gives us an advantage. And you know, sorry guys, that's just how it is.
That's how it is. Glenn, tell our listeners where they can find you. You have a website?
I sure do. It's the name of the book, which is 299days.com. So it's 299days.com. You can find the book on Amazon. You can just type in 299days and or Glenn Tate, and it's Glenn with one N, but 299days will get you there. And remember, there's 5 books, and by the time a lot of people listen to this, there might even be 6 books out. So if, you know, a book pops up, make sure it's book 1, you know, I think you want to start with that. And so know that there are many of them. And then I have Facebook. I'm a big Facebook fan. It's a great way to communicate. That's Glenn Tate, and there's about a jillion Glenn Tates out there. I picked as my pen name a very common name, and yes, that's not my real name. Given what I do for a living, it really can't get out that I'm doing this.
Sure.
And so the way to narrow down me on Facebook is Glenn Tate, and then use my email address to further narrow it, and that's glenntate123@gmail.com, glenntate123@gmail.com, and heck, you can send me an email. I love hearing from people. And then the book's Facebook site is 299days, parentheses, the book. And that's another great way to keep up on stuff. I have a lot of fresh content on my website, mostly pictures that people send me. The latest one, a squad of Marines in Kyrgyzstan, my publisher sent a bunch of books to them, and they read them and, you know, picture them with the books, and they love the books. I have pictures of people send me of their kids reading the books. I love it, the cute little kids and everything, and all kinds of cool scenes, and people from all over the world that you know, are fans and send me in a picture. I call it Patriot of the Week, and put stuff up about some of the conversations I have with law enforcement and military people. Obviously, I change things and protect their identities and everything. And the Walmart article we started talking about earlier was something that was sent to me by a reader. Thank you very much. And I put up on my Facebook page, and I also put it up on my website. So you can keep up on things, you know, relating to this topic by going to the website, Facebook, and all that other stuff.
Good, good. And we have links to buy all of Glenn's books through Amazon at the bottom of the page. Glenn, thanks a lot for making time to be on the show today. We had a good time.
Well, my pleasure, and thank you for what you're doing. Seriously, you're getting the word out, and that's how we're going to reach those suburban slugs I was talking about and change people, and a lot of people are going to make it through what's coming because they heard things like, you know, your podcast and other things. And it's a great time in history. If you want to do something good for the world, start getting the information out to people you know about prepping, and you might save their life, and that's a pretty high honor.
Sure, and everybody that you can help to get prepared is one less person that you have to feed or shoot, right?
Well said. Bad but true, but well said.
All right, Glenn, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to another edition of the Prepper Recon Podcast. If you're new to prepping and you want to learn more, you can check out our 7-step survival plan. It's under the categories section on the left-hand side of the page. Until next time, happy prepping.